guys, and welcome to episode 122 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now, in this episode, I got on Sharla Nicely. Now, Sharla's been on the show a few times. She's been a fan favourite, so hopefully you enjoy this one. So, Sharla came on to talk with me about her new book, Is Fred in the Refrigerator? Taming OCD and Reclaiming My Life. It's a book that's written like a fiction, but it's actually her life story. It's an entertaining read. It's educational. It shows some of the pitfalls people find when trying to get treatment in OCD. For example, her spending years trying to find the right therapist or clinician to help her. So there's lots of learnings in that sense if you're in that stage. But yeah, I get her on to ask her various things about her book. We go into it about the number one rule her OCD had for her, which was she couldn't tell anyone. If she did, the bad things would come true. We talked about a quote that Jonathan Grayson said in his girls support group that Sharla attended 8 years ago at the ISDF conference in Washington, which was about living in a world of uncertainty and being happy anyway. And that was the goal of ERP. So I got Sharla to unpack that. We talked about any roadblocks that she had in becoming a therapist and how did she overcome them. So hopefully that will help any qualifying trainees at the minute. We also talked about her new role. She talks about the end of the book, the new role she had for her OCD. And this was broken into four parts, which is, I can't judge this as good or bad. Allow for bigger plans than my own to unfold. Life is a classroom and I'm here to learn. And self-compassion. So we break that down, and Sharla gives her take on what all those things mean. And then the usual nice questions at the end. So as always, I enjoyed chatting with Sharla. I enjoyed reading her book. It's on pre-order now, if you're listening to this the day it comes out, but a couple of weeks after, if this has already been published, then the book should be on sale. But either way, if you go now, if you want it, you can get it on pre-order and it'll be shipped to you the day it's out. And don't forget, you can now become a member of the OCD Stories, get two extra episodes a month, as well as an extra article a week on the website. So head over to theocdstories.com/join to get those benefits and more. But without further ado, here is Sharla.
On today's episode of the OCD Stories podcast, I have Sharla Nicely. Sharla is an anxiety disorders treatment specialist in Atlanta, co-founder of beyondthedoubt.com, co-author of Everyday Mindfulness for OCD and author of the forthcoming book, Is Fred in the Refrigerator? Taming OCD and Reclaiming My Life. Welcome back to the show, Sharla.
Thanks for having me, Stu. It's great to be here.
It's good to have you back on. I was actually going to look up when the last time you were on, but then I forgot. But it must have been a fair while ago now.
Yeah, I think it was maybe 6 months or so ago, probably when Everyday Mindfulness came out, maybe the one that John and I did.
Oh, of course it was. Yeah, I'm thinking of the ERP episode, which was even longer ago. Yeah. And how's everything been since that book came out?
Everything's been good. It's been busy, but good.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's get into Is Fred in the Refrigerator, which is your new book. So it'd be good just to kind of hear the story about that. You know, what's it about, the style of it, etc.
So Is Fred in the Refrigerator is the story of my life with my monster, OCD. And I got the idea for it, in fact, when I was in my 30s and having an OCD episode about whether my cat was in the refrigerator. This is after I'd tried every treatment known to man, and nothing had worked because, of course, I hadn't had ERP yet, hadn't even heard of it yet. Yeah. But I was managing okay, and I could see what my OCD was doing to me every now and then and could sometimes stand back and laugh at what it was doing. And I had passed the refrigerator, and my OCD had said, oh, my gosh, is Fred in the refrigerator? And I'm like, I don't know. I've never thought of that before. And I'm like, but if he's in the refrigerator, that's really bad because it's cold. It's probably soundproof, so if he's trying to meow, we wouldn't be able to actually, like, have his voice heard, and he might like sit in there and freezing and being sad as his little organs shut down one by one and he died right there in the fridge. And I thought, well, I have to open the fridge door. So I opened the fridge and I looked inside. Of course, Fred's not there, and I closed it. But then, you know, my OCD's like, did you look behind the eggplant? And I'm like, Well, no, I didn't do that. So I opened the fridge door, look behind the eggplant. No, no Fred. And so I'm sitting there opening, closing the fridge door, completely stuck. And Fred walks by. And I'm like, hey, Fred. And it's like he looked at me and said, hey, Mom, what you doing? I'm like, I'm looking for you. He's like, okay. And he just goes into the room. And I'm standing out in front of the fridge. My cat has just walked by. I know he's not in the refrigerator. And yet I could not walk away. And I thought, there's got to be a story in here somewhere that from everything I've been through, all that my OCD has put me through, that I was managing. And I was having an okay life at this point. So I thought, you know, this would be a really great thing to do, to write a book about my adventures with OCD so far. Maybe I could help somebody. Yeah. And that was actually, and I thought, I'll call it Is Fred in the Refrigerator based on that episode. And that was actually what got me on the path towards looking up OCD online and finding the International OCD Foundation Conference, and then found they had a conference happening 2 weeks from that point. And that was in Washington, D.C. 8 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I went to that. And that's where I first learned about ERP. And that's where my real journey getting over OCD actually began, where I first learned about ERP and, you know, got treatment and, you know, spent the last 8 years sort of getting my monster tamed. So that's where that whole thing came from, was that OCD episode with my cat.
Oh, wow. And because obviously the conference is in Washington this year. Is it at the same hotel?
It's not. So it was at a smaller hotel 8 years ago. It was the Crystal City. I'm not quite sure which the hotel was, Marriott or Hyatt or something. Whereas this year it's at the Wardman Park Marriott. So it's a much bigger, because the conference is much bigger than it was 8 years ago.
Oh, shame. It kind of would have been great if it was the same hotel, because it was almost complete transformation, right?
I know. And I can still remember that hotel and those sessions and what it looked like so clearly, because it was so just jaw-dropping, the whole experience. But I think it's really neat that Fred is coming out the year that it's back in Washington. And that I'm actually presenting this year with Reed Wilson, who was my therapist. I did his weekend treatment group 8 years ago, right after the conference, and with Jeff Bell, who I heard him speak right after I heard Reed speak at the conference. That was the first time I'd ever heard anybody tell an OCD story, was Jeff's. And then with John Hirschfield, who helped me sort of improve my own mindfulness practice and asked me to write the book with him. And so they have been, all three of them have been such huge influences on my life and my recovery. So to get to present with them at a CDF conference. Say hello, Bella. He always likes to be on your podcast.
She's the cats.
Yes, and the cats will be coming soon too. They're not in the refrigerator. They're running around the house. So to get to present with them at this conference, 8 years later, is just really meaningful to me, because they've been such a huge part of really my recovery and of saving my life. So this is going to be, I think, a really special conference for me.
Okay, cool. And this talk you're doing with them, is it on the book or is it on something else?
It is called Power Up Your Recovery. So it actually is taking things that are from the book. It's not based on the book, but we'll be talking about things like leaning in toward your anxiety. So Reed's going to talk about this paradoxical stance that you take. Jeff's going to talk about greater good. John will talk about mindfulness. And we are going to record some super cool video for the mindfulness part that we're both really excited about, that I won't, you'll have to come to the talk to see what we're going to record, but it's going to be really cool. And then I'm going to talk about self-compassion. So we're going to talk about how to use all those tools. It'll be a workshop so that people can learn how to incorporate those to really power up and strengthen their recoveries.
Cool. Awesome. Yeah, I'll do my best to come along to that one. It sounds good.
That'd be great.
Cool. Right. So in your book, you've got a chapter called Rule Number One.
Yes.
And basically this rule was effectively your OCD telling you not to say anything, not to tell your family. This is you as a young child. And if you did, something bad would happen, or the bad things would come true. And for me, that was interesting, because for me as a child, I had similar but different as well, because it was you can't say anything, because if you do, you'll get locked up in an insane asylum and straitjacketed and all the weird stigma I had as a young kid about mental illness. But that was the fear, so I never said anything. So my question here is kind of, do you see this in your clients, like both those, your version, my version? And if so, I guess, how common is it, this feeling of not being able to tell anyone?
I think it's still relatively common. I think both because the disorder is what it is, you know, it feeds off shame. And if it can get you not to say anything to anybody, it keeps that veil of shame over you and keeps you more in its clutches. But I also think, too, just because of the stigma around both mental illness and OCD.
Yeah.
And I think especially, you know, too, in the States right now, with all that we've got going on the national scene with, you know, people committing atrocious acts and, you know, sometimes people are deemed to be mentally ill who've committed those acts and all of that. You know, I have a lot of clients talking to me and very worried about letting people know that they have a mental illness because there's such a stigma. And unfortunately, I think somewhat of a growing stigma around that. And so I think a lot of people are afraid to tell people. I mean, even to the point of being afraid to tell like a wife or a husband or a parent, you know, and so they really are going it alone. You know, most of the time my clients tell somebody knows. But it's rare that sort of everybody knows that they're dealing with this. It's typically a really small circle, but sometimes it's nobody at all. I think for the reasons that you and I both experienced, as well as unfortunately because of some of the stigma that's continuing to be around mental illness.
Yeah, no, good point. Okay, so the thing that I found myself shaking my head at in your book to do with your story quite a lot was the amount of clinicians you saw throughout your life and how long it took to get a diagnosis or get the right treatment, that is, for OCD. And I guess because things have changed, they are coming on, it's getting better all the time, but it's still far from where it should be, definitely in my country and in yours from what I gather, and I'm sure in a lot of the other countries listening. But I guess what advice do you have for any individuals who are starting that a treatment journey or looking for treatment, or parents of kids who have OCD? Kind of, I guess, how can they avoid the pitfalls that you found yourself in?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the first thing is to be your own advocate, or if you're a parent, be your child's advocate, which really means taking the time to do the research, to really understand about exposure therapy so that you can ask questions of a potential therapist and understand the answers. The International OCD Foundation has a great list of questions to ask potential therapists and the types of answers you're looking for. But I think the more that you understand as either somebody who's looking for treatment or a parent of somebody who's looking for treatment, the better. Because as you and I both know, there are lots of people who say they treat OCD out there who don't do exposure. I mean, that's, you know, what happened to me, what's happened to so many of us. So being able to make sure that you've got somebody who understands what ERP is and really is skilled at doing it, does it enough to really be able to understand and know the subtleties, I think is really important. I think the other thing is that if you're going to go into treatment, be willing to be honest with your therapist, even if you're not willing to tell anybody else, which I completely understand. And you want to be able to tell everything to your therapist because your OCD is just thriving off this secrecy, and your therapist needs to know absolutely every single little detail about what the OCD is doing so that he or she can help you best fight it. So I would say being an advocate, you know, make sure you're with somebody who knows ERP, and then being really honest with your therapist and open about what's going on.
Yeah, really, really good advice. It's kind of like OCD likes to hide in the dark, and the more truthful you are, the more light you shine kind of in your mind, and it has less places to hide. I think the other thing you said there, which I found really interesting, which is something I've never heard in this podcast, which is there are many CBT therapists who have been trained in exposure and response prevention therapy and who no doubt academically get it, know how to use it. But you said there about they've applied it enough times. And I think that's a good point of if you can find one that not only has been trained in it and is good enough if you can't find anyone else, but someone who's applied it over and over again for OCD, because it OCD is OCD, but it can come in so many different forms, which if someone's not fully understanding of OCD, can be hard to tackle. I think that was a good point by you there.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, and I think that's really super important because there are, I mean, exposure and response prevention is pretty straightforward, but there are lots of subtleties in the way that compulsions can manifest that can sabotage recovery. So the more experience, the better. But, you know, knowing that we're going to an audience of people like us with OCD, you don't want to look for the perfect therapist.
No.
It doesn't have to be the best therapist, the most well-trained therapist. If you've got somebody with ERP and that's who you can find, go with them.
Yeah.
But just, you know, if you can get somebody who's, you know, done it a lot, that's even better.
Oh, yeah. In an ideal world, yeah.
In an ideal world, right.
Yeah. Until then, good enough is good enough.
Right.
Okay, cool. Where's my next question? I always lose it. Right. So in your book, you did 8 years ago, you did the goal support group run by Jonathan Grayson, Dr. Jonathan Grayson, which is giving obsessive compulsives a different, how was it?
Another lifestyle, I think.
Another lifestyle, yeah. And that's his support groups are kind of goal based. Am I right in saying that? They're very recovery focused, and I really respect that.
Yeah.
So in this, you said there was a quote that really stuck with you, and I just wanted to get your take on it. The quote was, the goal of ERP was to live in a world of uncertainty and be happy anyway. So a couple parts there is how to live in a world of uncertainty and how to be happy anyway.
Well, I just loved John's quote because to me, it just like a light bulb moment, like, oh, that's what I'm trying to do, because we can't change the fact that the world is uncertain. And so I think, how do we live with uncertainty? That's really what we're trying to do with exposure therapy, is I think really understand the fact that we don't have control over really much of anything. Because that's what OCD is trying to do. It's trying to get control and certainty and comfort, the three C's. And its grasps for control, that's all the compulsions it's having us do. If we're willing to recognize, you know what, I really don't have control over that. And even if I do this thing you want me to do, OCD, it's still not going to give me any control over it. I mean, that's how we strip away some of its power.
Yeah.
And I think that's also really freeing. It's really scary, first, to think that we really don't have control over much of anything, but it's also really freeing. It's like, oh, well, I don't have much control over anything. That takes a lot of weight off your shoulders. And so I think that's the part about living in the uncertainty, is learning that you don't have control and learning to be okay with that through the process of exposure.
Yeah.
And I think the be happy anyway, and I'm really glad you asked this, because actually, as I'm thinking of the answer, I've never thought of it quite this way before, but this really gets to what I learned from Jeff Bell, which is that we have a choice about whether or not we believe the universe is friendly. And I think when you have untreated OCD, especially if it's severe, you know, life is not happy.
Yeah.
You are not having fun. You're in hell in a torture chamber all the time. But the more that you do exposure, the more that sort of the blue breaks through that stormy gray cloud above you and you can start seeing things. But sometimes we refuse to look at it. We refuse to see that blue because we are blinded by the way OCD sees things. OCD is negative Nelly. It only sees the bad stuff. You know, you could win $1 million and your OCD be like, oh, we're going to owe so much in taxes. I mean, you know, just nothing pleases it, right?
Yeah.
So I think that there's this be happy anyway thing that as you're getting better is really recognizing that it is a choice to keep seeing things from OCD's lens, which is the negative lens. And, or it's a choice to say, you know what? I could look at everything in the world as a miracle, and that's a choice.
Mm.
I can choose to think the universe is a supportive place that's not out to get me, and that's a choice. And if you do that, that further strengthens your recovery because it's pulling more out from under the OCD. It's pulling all those foundations it uses to keep us sick.
Yeah.
So I think that's sort of my answer to the two of those, how to be with the uncertainty and be happy anyway.
Yeah, really good point. I like the analogy of, or metaphor, the clouds breaking and that thin blue streak of clear sky coming through. And I agree, it's very hard, but sometimes it is a choice and a very hard choice, but Viktor Frankl says we always have a choice between stimulus and response. And it's like we can either be unhappy that we have 90% gray clouds, or we can latch on to that 10% and be unbelievably grateful that it's there, because there could be a time when it's not there. Or there has been a time, so it's like now that it's there, we appreciate it.
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So, towards the end of the book, you talk about a new rule. And this new rule is in four parts, and you have them engraved on four metal bracelets.
Yes.
Yeah. Cool. So it's audio, so Charlotte just lifted up her arms to show the bands. I forget. Okay, so it would be good just if we go through each one of those just to see why it's so meaningful to you and how it can be useful for others. So the first one was, I can't judge this as good or bad.
Yeah, so this was really important to my OCD recovery because my OCD would immediately slap a bad label on anything that wasn't going according to its plan. It has a very rigid way that it views the world and a very rigid set of outcomes that it's looking for. And anything that wasn't that was bad. And all that did was make me feel more scared and anxious about all these bad things that were happening. And when I had been in recovery for a couple of years, and especially started working with Jeff and our work and Beyond the Doubt, that's when I was coming up with these, is actually as Jeff and I were working on our four keys out when locked in doubt. The fourth key that we use is this letting go of control, which is really hard for those of us with OCD, but also sort of the essence of what we're trying to do. And as Jeff and I were sort of working on how to flesh out that fourth key, I started thinking about the fact that if I make a gratitude list of everything in my life that I'm grateful for, a lot of the things that are on that list, when they were happening, I was not grateful for them at all. I would have labeled them as bad, or my OCD would have labeled them as bad. But in fact, they've been really useful to me, or I've been able to turn them around in my life. So that's where this, we can't judge things as good or bad, came from, is because at the moment, it's really hard to know whether something is good or bad. We have to let things play out. And it might actually be it's neither. It's sort of neutral. But a lot of things will, you know, sort of turn out okay in the end if we can pull back and avoid labeling it. So that's a really important part to me, because if I've labeled it as bad, well, now, you know, I'm already playing OCD's game again.
Yeah. No, really good. And you give the parable of the Chinese farmer, which I love.
Yes.
So I'll let people read that in the book. Okay, so next one is allow for bigger plans than my own to unfold.
Yeah, so I stole this from Jeff. His work has been incredibly influential for me. This is in his book, When in Doubt, Make Belief. And what I like about this is that, I mean, really allow bigger plans than my own to unfold are sort of the story of my life. Because, you know, when I was growing up, I wanted to be first a veterinarian, and then I sort of let that go because I don't do very well with blood. even though I've done a lot of exposure work on that, I'm better now. but then I wanted to be a CEO. That was sort of my goal. You know, I went back to school after I'd been out in the work world for a while and got an MBA, and I was working in corporate marketing, and I'm like, I am headed for the CEO's office, and I am as far from that as you could possibly be right now. I sit here in my jeans on a Friday afternoon.
Well, you are a CEO, though, of your own company.
CEO of my own little world, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, if I'd sort of stuck with that path, I mean, I'd be miserable in a corporate job. I'd be completely miserable as a CEO. The bigger plan than my own was really sort of recognizing that the biggest calling I have is to turn my own knowledge of OCD and my passion for helping people get better, to becoming a therapist, which is totally different than being a CEO. So I think recognizing that we can have plans, and there's nothing wrong with having plans, but when things start to go off course, you know, obviously we feel disappointment, and that's okay, but also being able to step back and say, you know what, maybe this means that there's something better on the horizon for me if I just sort of let this play out.
Yeah, really good. That's a piece of advice I'm taking in my own life at the minute. There's stuff that's not gone according to plan, and it's having the faith that it will work out, that there's something bigger going on that I need to allow to happen, and that means living with uncertainty.
Yes.
As uncomfortable as that is.
Yes.
Okay, so the next one is, life is a classroom and I'm here to learn.
So I think that is, for me, setting up that I don't have to be perfect. That it's not like my life is some if you think about it in like a theater terms, like it's not like, oh my gosh, this is the performance with all this really important audience for me. I have to do this perfectly because I only have this one shot. it's more like, you know, life is a bunch of dress rehearsals over and over and over again for things. And it's okay to make mistakes because life is about learning from your mistakes. In fact, you know, there's a quote, and I won't remember who said this, but you know, an expert is somebody who's made all the mistakes there are to make in a given field. Yeah. I thought that's perfect. I love that. So I think embracing the mistakes, embracing that if life is a classroom, then that's where you make mistakes. That's where you try things. That's where you take risks. That's where you push yourself out of your comfort zone because, you know, meaning, quoting Susan David here from her great TED Talk, The Gift and Power of Emotional Courage, you know, meaning is or discomfort is the price of admission to a meaningful life.
Yeah, wow, yeah. I've never actually seen that. I'm making a note of it now. And I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, it's a great one.
Okay, great. And yeah, I agree. It's kind of giving yourself permission to fail and not realizing that the failure is going to be catastrophic because 99.9% of the times it's not. And you always learn, right? Like you say, if you're willing to fail, you're going to learn. And you're going to get beyond someone who's winning all the time to start with because they're not learning usually. They're celebrating.
Yes. And quoting Winston Churchill, so what he said was success is going from failure to failure without loss of enthusiasm. And I love that. Yeah. Such a great way to think about it.
Yeah. And an important quote during World War II.
yes, very.
He needed to keep going. okay, so the last one is, and one of my favorites, self-compassion.
Yes, so self-compassion is important because life is a classroom and we're here to learn. Yeah. So if we're going to make mistakes, we have to give ourselves the grace to do that. Mm-hmm. And so self-compassion is so important for all of us with OCD, and it was especially important for me because my mind is a jerk. I mean, my OCD is so ruthlessly mean and demeaning. And, you know, before I got treatment for OCD, I mean, just all day long, it was constant harangue that sounded something like, what is wrong with you? You messed up again. Oh my God. Do you see these other people messing up? You are just a complete failure. Come on, get it together. That was sort of what I heard constantly. So no wonder I was anxious and stressed. And once I learned about self-compassion, I'm like, oh, you mean I don't have to talk to myself like that? Because I'd really picked up my OCD's voice and I'd made it my own because that's how my OCD talked to me. So that self-critical voice was just reinforcing everything the OCD was saying. And when I learned that I could be nice to myself, wow, it was just a complete change in how I felt about myself because I was able to sort of comfort myself and give myself forgiveness and compassion, understanding how I would treat a best friend, you know, how I treat Sydney from Fred. You know, I wouldn't go to her and go, what is wrong with you, Sydney? Come on, man. You know, I would be like she was with me in the book, very compassionate and understanding. So self-compassion is so incredibly important, but it's also not second nature to me, which is why I wear these bracelets. None of this still is second nature to me. I have to work on all this, but these bracelets remind me every time I look down and especially see the self-compassion one, I'm like, right, yes. I'm not alone. Other people feel like I'm feeling. And you know what? It's okay. I'm going to give myself a break because I'm pushing myself out of my comfort zone. And that is what living is all about.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Really good point. And I think it's a good point you made there about having to remind yourself constantly by having the bracelets on. Self-compassion doesn't come naturally to you because I think a lot of people that have very negative critical thoughts will sometimes use the excuse, and I can say excuse, use the excuse that it's just not natural to me. You know, I'm not a compassionate person. I don't deserve to love myself. But what I always say and what you allude to there is self-compassion is a skill. It doesn't have to come naturally. It's something you can work on every day. And more importantly that, it's something that's worthwhile working on every day.
Yes. And I think that there are a subset of us, and I think I have been in this subset in the past, of people with OCD who do self-punishment as a ritual. Mm. So one of the ritual things we do is we beat ourselves up almost to get that like absolution, that feeling of, well, gosh, I'm sort of atoning for my sins by beating myself up. Sins in quotes, of course, because we haven't actually done anything wrong. And for those folks, you know, self-compassion does feel bad because it's an exposure to give themselves compassion. And so that may be part of when people say, I'm just not a compassionate person either. You know, they might be punishing themselves as part of their ritualistic OCD behavior. And the self-compassion is going to feel awful. And that means it's even more important because it's an exposure. And through the process of doing it over and over again, eventually it'll come to feel good, like it feels for people who aren't doing self-punishment as a ritual.
Yeah. Yeah, really good point. And there's one of those subtle nuances of OCD that you'll probably only understand through years and years of working with people with OCD.
Yes. Or
having it yourself. Okay, so the next one is, so in the book you talk about, you had the first idea of writing this in 2010, and you actually said this on this podcast earlier, 8 years ago. So my question is, what eventually got you to the point of actually writing it?
Such a good question. Fred has had so many different lives. You know, I looked back at my Word documents folder. There was one version of Fred that was all written in letters back and forth that I gave up on. There was another version that was way more fictionalized that I gave up on. And so I was trying different things. In fact, I let my friend Priscilla, who I worked with at Accelent, at one of the tech companies that I worked with years ago, I let her read another different version that I was writing. And she stopped reading and she looked at me and she said, Charlotte, I hate to say this, but this sounds like a treatment manual. and I said, okay. She goes, what people want is a really good story. I'm like, okay, yeah, you're right. In fact, I thank her in the acknowledgement section because that was such a pivotal moment for me, because I'm like, yes, what people want is a good story. And I think knowing that was hard, because I'm like, oh, it's got to be good. And, you know, there was about this OCD. It's like, oh, it's got to be good. Why even get started, right? You know, Yeah. It's got to be perfect with every word on the page. And so I think there was a lot of procrastination on my part, just trying to get this good story together. And then there was sort of just the busyness of learning ERP and going back to graduate school and all of that. Mm-hmm. But eventually, after I'd written a couple chapters of the current version of Fred, I decided to tell Jeff that I was writing this, and I wanted to have somebody who understood OCD hear it, listen to it, read it, and give me some opinions on it. And when I was out in the San Francisco area driving around with him as we were doing Beyond the Doubt stuff, I would just read him these chapters, and he really loved them. I can tell that he wasn't like just putting me on. He seemed to really like me. He's like, Shaw, this is really good. I really think you've got to keep going. I'm like, really? He's like, yeah, you really have to make time to do this. And so I would then write chapters, and I have to admit, this is a little bit reassurance seeking, right? But I'd write it and be like, okay, Jeff, I've written another chapter. And so I would read in the chapters, like, that's great, Shaw, keep going. I read him the whole book, and the whole thing was way longer than it is now. Like, I cut probably 50,000 words out of the book. So I cut almost half the whole book. So he's heard this whole huge version of Fred. And it was really, you know, his enthusiasm for this that helped me, because it was hard, having never done anything like this before, to sort of know what I was doing and know if what I was doing was something that anybody would find the time to worth reading, you know. Yeah. And so it really helped to have his enthusiasm. And, you know, I have to give Jeff credit, too, because he's listened to the whole thing twice. Because he wrote the foreword. And so I read the version that's actually going to be published now. While we were doing stuff, you know, I read this current version to him, you know, on various things we'd be doing for Beyond the Doubt. So he's actually heard it out loud twice. so I have to give Jeff a lot of credit. And that his enthusiasm really helped me write this book, because I felt like I was sort of writing it for him. Like, okay, I'm writing this next chapter. Let me give it to Jeff to read. And it was, you know, it was great. You know, Jeff and I have been business partners for years now, and it's just been really helpful to have somebody that I could really trust, that I could share all this with and get some honest feedback. So I think that's what really got me writing Fred, was having that enthusiasm from somebody else to sort of push me forward.
Yeah, no, that's really good. And yeah, absolutely. Having the right people around you, it just shows you there how important it is. Because otherwise you may have done it anyway, so I don't want to discredit you there. But equally, you may have, knowing me in that situation, would have been kind of overpowered by self-doubt, procrastination, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, I agree. And, you know, even though some of it probably was quite a bit of reassurance seeking, you know, now that I'm like saying all this out loud, all right, so you know, I'm not perfect. I'll use my self-compassion on this too, right? I really do think, yeah, it was probably really helpful to me because I, you know, over the last 8 years, I really have spent trying to get my life back in order. And I, you know, I did have a lot of OCD. And so having that person to sort of help me and prop me up and tell me I could do this was really, really helpful.
Cool. Yeah, no, that's good to hear. Okay, so a question now around training and therapy, you know, because I myself kind of on that journey, and for any other trainees listening, what was the hardest roadblock you found in becoming a therapist, and how did you overcome it?
My OCD was the biggest roadblock. It didn't want me to do this because to my OCD, this is the riskiest job I could possibly have would be to help somebody else. I mean, I guess being an emergency room physician to my OCD would probably be like right up here with being a counselor helping people with OCD because it sees it like that. Yeah. It sees this as very risky because I'm helping other people take their lives back. And so people are depending on me to help give them guidance that works, you know, based on what the research says. And my OCD didn't like all the uncertainties around that, like all these ethical things and legal responsibilities and all these kinds of insurance. Well, why do we need that kind of insurance if bad things aren't going to happen? You know, and it would just flip out about all this. And so it made becoming a therapist hard because it would get enraged as soon as it would find out something new about some other type of risk, quote unquote risk, that I was undertaking by becoming a therapist. You know, it would go into its active sort of triad of hell state and make my life miserable because it was all unknown. I mean, I understood sales and marketing, what I had done for 20 years, really well. But I didn't understand this at all. And it would play off all that uncertainty and all those unknowns to sort of spin things out of control. So I had to do a lot of ERP about learning how to do ERP with other people because my OCD just didn't want me to do this.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm nodding my head because right now, you know, I had a lecture the other day, and it was a guy came in from the higher course and was like, once you get a certain amount of hours, if you want to come on the next course, which would effectively by the end of it make me an accredited CBT therapist in the UK, you know, he did hammer home the whole not the dangers of it, but the responsibility you're taking on, your, you know, people's lives and all this, and all the ethical stuff, and all I'm thinking is I'm just dying inside slowly, like there's too much uncertainty here, this isn't worth it. you don't want to spend your life being unhappy, da, da, da. So yeah, that's for me where I need to live with that and overcome that at the minute, but yeah, I can relate.
I think with the hardest thing, and the other people that I know who have and treat OCD, we all joke about this, the biggest exposure for each of us is going to the required ethics CEU events that we have to do either every year or every other year, where you just have to walk in going, this is going to be a 5-hour exposure, baby. Because my OCD is going to be like, oh my God, did we do that? Did we do that? We do that? It's going to be like searching through the memory trove, trying to figure out if we did anything. And in fact, the one I signed up to go to this year, specifically to bother my OCD, is one all about the ethics of self-disclosure. I'm like, well, this will be good. Since I just wrote a book disclosing sort of everything about my OCD that any of my clients are welcome to read, this is going to be a great CEU to to, because my OCD is going to absolutely come unglued, which will be great.
I agree. Yeah, having written that book, then no doubt it's going to play on you. Self-disclosure for me is kind of a mute point. I think as long as it's done in moderation, I think it's one of the most powerful tools a therapist has.
Yes.
When I've done it in my sessions, I'm not a therapist, I want to put on the air, but I'm training in interventions anyway. When I've done it, I've seen the biggest growth in therapeutic alliance with the person I'm working with. And when I don't do that, I don't have as strong as connection, and then it doesn't work as well. I wanted to throw that out there. No doubt it's going to latch on. But maybe you should stand up and tell everyone you've written a book about your life.
Well, I think I'm probably going to do that because that will really upset my OCD too. So the more than I could do to upset it, the better.
Playing this podcast. Okay, so I've got one more question now at the end, which is if you could pick up the phone to your 20-year-old self, what would you tell Sharla?
Oh, wow. That's a really good question. My 20-year-old self.
So it doesn't necessarily have to be OCD related if you don't want it to be.
I think I would say, hang on. Sort of, you're in for a wild ride. It's going to be sort of terrible at times. You're going to wonder why you're even living at times. You are going to experience some great things at times, but it's going to take you a while to get there, and that's okay. I think that, so I guess what I'm saying is, would I go back and tell my 20-year-old self to do different things? Yes, but it would have been great, obviously, if I'd gotten treatment at age 20, but maybe there's a reason I didn't. Maybe I'm a better therapist because I had untreated OCD for that many years. Maybe this was the course that my life was supposed to take. In fact, so I'm a huge Lost fan. and there's some time travel in Lost, which I love. And there was this scene in Lost where John Locke, one of the main characters, was watching himself do some things. And he was with one of the other characters, and the other character says, "Aren't you going to go try to fix it?" And he said, "No." He goes, "I needed to do that to get to where I am right now." And that really resonated with me, is that, life with OCD has been sort of hell at times, but it's gotten me to where I am today, and I like where I am today. I certainly didn't want to suffer as much as I did. I certainly, would prefer not to make a lot of the mistakes that I made with careers and relationships and all that kind of stuff because of my OCD. But maybe there was a purpose in it. I guess this comes back to this: I can't judge things as good or bad. So I guess I would tell my 20-year-old self to hang on. It's going to be quite a ride, but it's going to be worth it.
Good advice. Good advice. I like it. Okay, so obviously, I'll put the links to the book is Fred in the Refrigerator on the show notes, and obviously they can search for it on Amazon.
Bella wants
It's
to
my
say goodbye to
voice.
everybody.
And obviously it's on pre-order now, but in a couple of weeks it won't be. They can buy it, but obviously if you get it on pre-order, you'll get it shipped the day it comes out. But is there anything else you want to share that I haven't asked you?
I'd say yes. So the one of the things that I'd like to share that I think is really important, and one of the reasons that I wrote Fred, is that if you're out there and you're listening to this and you have had OCD and you've had it for a long time and treatment's not going well and you feel like you're still suffering, I get it. That was me too. And it took me a very long time to really learn how to do ERP correctly, years, in fact. In fact, I consider that it's taken really 8 years for me to get better from that time that I was at that first conference 8 years ago to now, and I'm still a work in process. And that's just because, I did a lot of it on my own. There was a lot of trial and error. I had a lot of really untreated active OCD, so I don't think it's going to take everybody 8 years. But I think what I'm saying is that it is a process getting better, one that is not a straight line, and that what's most important is to never ever give up. So if you're out there and you've been in treatment for a long time, or been suffering for a long time, and you're thinking about treatment, it's going to take time, and that's okay. Give yourself self-compassion, give yourself grace, give yourself time to go through it, and know that that's okay. That success is seeing it as a journey, not as a destination.
Really good advice. Great finishing words. And thank you for always for coming on and giving us your time.
Thanks for having me, Sue. It's been a lot of fun.
So there you have it. I hope you enjoyed my episode with Sharla. Everything we discussed will be in the show notes at theocdstories.com. And don't forget, disclaimer, this podcast is not therapy, it's not a replacement for therapy, and nor should it be. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And don't forget, if you want to become a member, head over to theocdstories.com/join. And until next time, take care.